All right, I'll be bottom.
You did that on purpose.
Well, a little bit. I just didn't think you would react so strongly to that. It's just you're always bottom. I'm always top. I'm bottom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim.
And I'm Ryan.
And this is the Concept Crucible Podcast.
Season finale.
Season finale.
Part two.
Yes. Because if you weren't watching our last or listening to our last podcast, you can find the link for it around us and in the show notes. And we defined and virtue ethics and provided some resources to read about that, because today is the second part of the two-part virtue ethics throwdown. But first, Icebreaker. All right. Since it's a season finale, we're going to take the opportunity to talk about our own stuff. Mm-hmm. So, Ryan, we have recorded, I believe, 19 podcasts now, not counting the special audio edition, so it brings us up to 21. Yeah. So, what was the best podcast to record, but also what was the hardest podcast to record?
All right, so I'd say the best, or at least one of my favorites to record, was when we discussed our philosophical stories. Mostly because it didn't really require a lot of work, but it was just really interesting to see how our history sent us into the direction of studying philosophy at UW, because it teases out that idea that nobody really comes into philosophy through one route, and nobody really wants to get into philosophy for one particular job.
Very few people's parents are like, you know what, you should study philosophy,
right? But it was really interesting to see how our own life experiences ended up shaping those decisions to lead it. So it was really fun to talk about it and to see how, like, rehash my story, but also find out what your story was. So I really enjoyed that.
What about the hardest?
The hardest was probably our class discussion, when we discussed class. And for me, it was difficult, A, because I originally came into that planning session expecting to talk about politics.
You and me both.
Expecting to talk about provincial politics, because at the time, the provincial elections had just happened. And then as of recording now, I mean, our municipal elections have just passed.
Yep.
So I came into it expecting to talk about one thing. And then through our discussion and our planning, we realized that there was a much more interesting concept or a much more interesting thing to talk about. And what became really difficult for me in talking about class, and I don't think it has anything to do with me confronting my own privilege. I mean, that's uncomfortable in and of itself, but I don't think that was the problem. The problem for me was I didn't really have a lot to contribute. I felt very out of my element in that discussion. I mean, you and I joked a little bit about, you know, you're moving up when the cheese starts to change at your social gatherings. You know, we could laugh about things like that, but it was, for me, it was a real struggle to try to meaningfully bring myself into that conversation and talk about things that really, if I did experience them in life, they were when I was really young, or it involved, like, my mother and other elements of my life that just I had no control over. Mm-hmm. So I would say that was the hardest to film. But in a general, looking over the last season, it was a really fun project to get involved with. And it was just interesting to come, you know, week after week or every other week when we got together to film and to just be able to explore these ideas. I mean, I don't think we talked about it much when we first started, but the goal of the podcast was to capture our conversations that we had over dinner on video and then put them up on the internet.
Ironically, then we started eating dinner first and then making the videos.
And then having entirely better conversations before we made the videos. I would say it's been a good run for this season. I'm looking forward to next season. And I want to give a shout out to Courtney and Eleni and
it's like romper room up in this. Christy.
And Christy and my buddy Luke. I found out when I went and visited my folks this weekend that my stepmom watches a few episodes here and there.
David and Drew and all of our really faithful listeners who also leave comments.
Yeah.
If you leave comments, you may wind up in a shout out in season two, which is super fun.
Yeah. So thank you for everybody for following us and helping us out with season one. So Jim, what was your favorite? What was the hardest? And what are your general thoughts on season
this
one?
This is getting complicated. This is like a three-question icebreaker.
All right, so
my favorite one is probably Art of Unemployment. Self-care is something I think about a lot. Self-care is something I take really seriously. And it is something that I recommend for basically any human ever. You know, there's a point where your sanity and your happiness have to come first, and there is a part of life where it can be really hard to strike that balance. It is a thing that I struggle with, is a thing that I know lots of other people struggle with. So it was and since making the Art of Unemployment podcast, which you of course can find over Huck's Face and in the show notes, I have gotten some really positive feedback from people about, you know, whether it's helped them structure their routine or help them think about what they want to get done. I mean, because everybody works and takes care of themselves differently, but if we can help some people deal with some of the stress that happens when that's a part of your life, then that to me is the best. Mm-hmm. Hardest podcast. Also, the class podcast, but for different reasons. That my experience of class warfare is very strong and very direct, and that podcast brought up a lot of really personal stuff. That there are definitely a few moments in it. You can probably see it in the video where I am like close to tears. Or shaking with anger, which I'm not supposed to do because I'm the funny guy. You're the serious guy, Ryan. That's how this works.
Know your role.
But, yeah, so I... That was definitely the hardest one for me because it was emotionally difficult. And I look forward. I enjoy it because of that, but at the same time, it was a big sort of hurdle to step over. And reflections on the season. I don't know. We got a whole season.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Oh. But I am excited for season two. But that's partly because we've already planned a bunch of season two, so I know what's going to happen, and I can tell everybody listening that it's going to be super cool.
Before we launch the discussion, just to continue the icebreaker for a minute. So you filmed a fair number of vlogs, and then you filmed this first season. What do you have any thoughts about what it's like vlogging and doing the podcasting? For me, this is the first time I've ever done anything like this. Do you find that these kinds of things are stimulating, or do you?
They are, and the more of it you do, much like practicing virtue ethics. Nice segue that I'm going to abandon. The more of it you do, the easier it is to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have actually, as we are recording this, I have not recorded a vlog in quite a while that I have put out because I have had a ton of other stuff going on, and I viscerally regret it.
Mm-hmm.
When a day goes by and I don't, like, make a video or post a video or write a blog post, I'm like, man, I really wanted to write about that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or do a video about that thing. And I just, but it's like any other habit.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is once you get the bug for it, it's great. I've probably, I don't know, in the past 3 years, I've written over 600 blog posts. I've made over 200 videos, and I still want to make more.
Mm-hmm.
Still got fun stuff that I want to do or fun places I want to go. But yeah, it's been a while. And it's been too long, but it's my reflections on how this is different. It's a lot more structured because we have to work together on it, and especially working with Ryan and Gina on the audio versions. It can be. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, during October, because October was Halloween month, we put out two special edition audio casts with some awesome costume rioters. And you should go check them out. The link is in the show notes. If you are listening to this, then you already know about those episodes, and you're super cool. Also, you should duck, because you're probably, like, walking through a public place. Anyway. No, my reflections on how the podcast is different. For one thing, I usually don't eat dinner before I make videos. I usually do it after. But also, it's more structured. We tend to have more notes because we want to have a better discussion, and because we have to be able to talk about it, and because we don't edit it. Mm-hmm. We do the whole podcast in one take, which means you get the ums and ahs and all of the bits of us being human beings, but it also means that we need to be on the ball when it comes to our topic, as opposed to a video where I have definitely had that video where I deliver the same line 12 times and then just take the one I want. Mm-hmm. You know, because you've got to have more energy. You've got to have more, you know, be more upbeat because it's only 5 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Whereas the podcast is, you know, 35, 40. But yeah, I'm very satisfied with what we've done. I'm really looking forward to next season. If you who are listening are also looking forward to next season, or if there's something cool that you would like to hear us talk about next season, by all means, leave a comment, and we will probably reply to it, and we will probably even do it. Though we do have a bunch of cool things already planned. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is the second part of the Virtue Ethics Throwdown, the two-part Virtue Ethics Throwdown, and I, today, will take the piss out of Virtue Ethics.
And it's going to be fun, because I have not academically engaged with virtue ethics in a little bit, and so a lot of my answers are just going to come from me trying to work through how I'm going to rationalize and defend virtue ethics.
So there might not be a season two, because Ryan and I might not be friends after this, is what we're saying. No, virtue ethics, we talked about it last episode. We talked about what it is, the sort of Aristotelian motto of doing the right thing at the right time in the right place, the nature of moral virtues like courage and temperance and wisdom, the rule of the mean, the notion that every virtue exists on a continuum, and it lies in the middle, and we talked about paragons, who are the people that you look up to and embody a specific virtue or a set of virtues. And the first problem I have, and this is, I mean collective scholarship that did not pull this all from our own. The first problem, Ryan, that Immanuel Kant has, as he, because he's the one that, well, he's the first one where I read this one, Foundations of a Metaphysics of Morals. I always get the title wrong. But is that these virtues, temperance and wisdom and courage, they don't necessitate that I do good things. I mean, in the same way that there's nothing about slavery in the Ten Commandments. There's nothing about compassion in these virtues. There's nothing that compels me to take an interest in others or in their well-being. Or in my own goodness. It merely necessitates that I am brave and wise and do things in moderation. But that would make me an excellent villain. Mm-hmm. I mean, many villains are brave. And they take incredible risks. For the purposes of this, I am not talking about actual real-life villains because I am hesitant to compliment Pol Pot, but fictional villains like the Penguin. I mean, at every moment, the Penguin has to worry about Batman bursting through his roof and punching his face in. Mm-hmm. So he has to take all kinds of risks, Not to mention Batman, he has to worry about other villains, like Two-Face, or Killer Croc, or the Joker. And they're just going to, I mean, they could just kick in his doors and shoot up his place or take his things. And so it seems like he has to be brave. He also has to exercise moderation. If he commits too many crimes, police take an interest. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Batman takes an interest, which is even worse. But if he doesn't commit any crimes at all, not only does he, you know, damage his income, but he loses his reputation as a criminal, which is for him almost worse. You know, it's hard for him to exist in a criminal world if he's not committing some kind of villainy. Mm-hmm. So temperance, you know, the right amount of crimes seems perfectly fine. And wisdom, I mean, everybody wants to have wisdom. Wisdom mm-hmm. is what helps you not get caught. Mm-hmm. Is the Penguin a virtuous guy?
So my immediate reaction to that is that has less to do with virtues and more to do with being just a good criminal. But I don't think that's necessarily virtues. And the reason why I say that is, well, first, okay, so I'm going to be a little bit blasphemous here and say that just because...
You're going to talk about Batman in a negative way?
No, I am going to anti-whoop-nig it and say that Aristotle does not necessarily have the definitive, all-encompassing account of virtue ethics. I don't think that just because it's not written in Aristotle's works means that it's something that is a short falling of
okay.
a theory.
No, that seems fairly reasonable. But I mean, even if you move forward to Aquinas bases his ethics on Aristotle.
And actually, Aquinas would be a good example here because he's starting to infuse some of the Christian virtues mm-hmm. into it. I would say, like, for example, compassion is probably a mean between two extremes of almost apathy mm-hmm. and caring so much that it hurts you. I think you can be, in some regards, compassionate without regard to your own well-being.
Ooh.
So I think that just because Aristotle, as a Greek man, a Greek free man, did not write about compassion, doesn't mean that that it's not a true virtue.
Okay.
So I think a virtuous person would have compassion and would display the right levels of compassion. For example, if you do want to go with Batman and you want to take a specific example from the movies, Batman does not show Ra's al Ghul compassion the second time they meet on the train.
Yeah.
He says, like, I don't have to save you. You know, I'm not going to kill you. So I'm not going to go that extreme.
I feel like, though, not saving someone
is probably wrong.
Is killing them.
Yeah. No, it's probably wrong. I'm saying, but I mean, like, but a lot of people tend to hold that action as somehow being good. Now, granted, the Christopher Nolan movies are a fantastic case study of just what happens in a post 9/11 world and how we view heroes and how we view security and how we view, like, the state and whatnot. Like, mm-hmm. it's wrong for the state to have the NSA spying on everybody, but it's perfectly fine for a Batman to find the Joker that way. You know, it's really funny to see how we applaud a hero in one sense and vilify a government for ostensibly trying to do or have the same outcome of catching bad guys.
That is an entirely different step.
So I'm coming back to it. So for example, I think you can make a strong case that compassion is a virtue. And I think that especially with the person that you are, that would resonate really strongly with you. Because compassion isn't very
important.
It's
interesting to me because in some of the virtue ethics scholarship that I've been reading to prepare for this, I think it wasn't Herseth, it was Foote, who says that because virtue is a property of the will, it has to come from goodwill. Mm-hmm. You have to do things for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's not a virtue. It's just an action that resembles a virtue. Mm-hmm. And I find the notion of compassion as a central virtue more compelling than that. Mm-hmm. I am entirely doing Philippa Foote's argument a disservice, but mm-hmm. that is sort of the issue with having a 40-minute podcast. Mm-hmm. But
and for example, you have a good will. You can have a good will and still discharge compassion poorly. Mm-hmm. I'm categorizing too much. The college-age student who goes over to a third-world country to build stuff is showing compassion, but might not be doing the right thing for that community, right? Okay. So, I mean, like, there are good actions.
So you have to exercise your compassion and temper it with courage and wisdom and temperance and virtues like that.
Yeah, and be sensitive to cultural needs. So this brings
me into a different problem.
So, well, let's just in terms of the virtuous villains, I think that, yeah, you can be extremely moderate, you can be extremely temperate, you can be extremely courageous, but I don't necessarily think that that's a problem for the virtue ethicists to think of, because they're really good at the skills that allow them to be a criminal, but that doesn't necessarily make them a virtuous person.
Okay, so here's the thing is that, so... We've got a person who is compassionate and who compassion, like you say, it works in conjunction with other virtues. And one of the other arguments that comes up a lot in virtue ethics is in order to have one virtue really, to truly have it, because you have to do it in the right place, at the right time, you have to have all of the virtues. Mm-hmm. I mean, compassion is useless if you are not brave enough to act on it.
Mm-hmm. Allies. Yeah. Perfect example from last episode.
Yeah. Courage is useless if you're drunk all the time. Mm-hmm. And if you are intemperate. Mm-hmm. We can look at temperance. Temperance is useless if it is born out of cowardice. If you do not drink or partake in things because you are afraid, then that is different than if you do not do so because you are in control. Mm-hmm. I'm not about to cast a judgment on that, but I think we can agree that there's an appreciable difference there. Mm-hmm. And those are so. The issue with having, I mean, you can't even really have compassion without having all of the other ones.
Yeah, this is, you've brought this up before, I believe, at least in the pre-discussions we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. This is where I weasel my way out of the problem with sticking to my cherry-picking virtue ethicist. I think... In Aristotle's idealized case, or in anybody else who writes about the idealized moral virtue or moral paragon, they do have it. I think that reality, we have to face reality that we're not perfect. We're not ideally rational. That's why, like, economics, a lot of flaws in economics can be stemmed to just assuming an ideal rational agent.
Yes.
Right? So I think we abstract away from the way we really are, and we don't appreciate those kind of limitations, and why I'm perfectly happy with cherry picking virtues from different people, and being comfortable with that despite that person being not a bad person, but despite that person maybe having moral flaws in other areas of their life.
So the thing that bothers me about it, though, and we talked last episode, right near the end, about normative ideals and the idea that it is okay to set a goal and have a goal that you can never reach. Mm-hmm. But the notion of completeness, of needing all virtues in order to have one of them, means that not only can I never be a truly virtuous person, I can never even have one.
Is that the way it's cashed out, though? Is it you can't have any of the virtues unless you have them all? Or is it you cannot be a good person, or you cannot be wise unless you have them all?
That's the thing, is the example of courage. You need wisdom and temperance in order to be properly courageous. You need courage and wisdom in order to be properly temperate.
See, I would say you can have courage in the absence of wisdom. It's just you're not.
If you have courage in the absence of wisdom, then you are courageous when it is foolish to be so.
Yeah, so, it's kind of hard to it's kind of hard to weasel my way out of this one. The only thing I can say in regards to that really is, like, you have maybe to split my terms so that I'm not equivocating. You have bravery, you just don't know how to channel it appropriately. It's kind of like you have the strength to be able to draw a bow, but you don't have the skill to be able to shoot the arrow at the target.
Okay, right? but I mean, if that is true, then since you don't use your courage at the right time, in the right way, then you don't have the virtue of courage.
No, true. And you know what? When pressed all the way, I'll just agree with you. Yeah, I guess if you don't have,
it's a problem.
Yeah, if you don't have all the virtues, you have none of them. And I'll just default to what I said last time. You just have to accept that you are failing most of your life.
All of your life.
I guess you can never reach
it. At any virtue. That seems highly demoralizing.
I don't know. I find life demoralizing in general. The quicker you can accept
Welcome to the existential terror of being a philosopher.
Yeah.
No, I think it's okay to bite the bullet on that. I just think that as ethical systems go, one that doesn't offer you any kind of payoff and instead offers you nothing but a lifetime of struggle toward an impossible ideal, like a truly impossible ideal to which you could not even achieve one tiny piece. Well, there is something really super ancient Greek about it.
Or French, because you know what? I need to get around to reading the original, the essay, but I've read enough about it, and I've read, especially the analogy, The Myth of Sisyphus in Camus.
Oh, it's a good time.
Finding meaning in the struggle that ultimately is...
There's something vaguely existential about that.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. I never formally studied existentialism, but, you know, I've read Camus, a little bit of Camus and Sartre and whatnot, Kierkegaard and whatnot. There's something
fundamentally existential about that.
Yeah. I personally don't have a problem with the idea of constantly striving towards
an impossible goal.
Because I do find meaning in the struggle, and I find meaning in making progress. It's kind of like me working out at the gym.
I guess.
You know, I'm never...
I suppose if your impossible goal at the gym is to, like, lift a house or turn invisible...
Yeah.
Or leap a tall building in a single bound?
Well, I think there's impossible, and then there's unreasonable, and then there's reasonable. I mean, it's reasonable for me to continue to build on strength. It's fairly unreasonable of me to ever expect to be a cover model, right? To drop down to 4% body fat and below to be able to display muscle.
What do you think, commenters? Rate this Ryan.
I think it's slightly unreasonable to me to expect to get to that point. But as long as I don't have an unreasonable expectation, but I can still work towards it, you know.
All right, we'll bracket it.
Okay.
Paragons.
Mm-hmm.
So, I worry about paragons, and I worry about paragons because of Jordan Belfort.
And explain who Jordan Belfort is.
So Jordan Belfort was a con man and a trader and a stockbroker and a salesman. And he had a movie come out last year, this year, earlier this year, about him and his life. The Wolf of Wall Street, it's a great movie. And lots of people really admire Jordan Belfort for his go-get-em attitude. Because he had such a giant go-get-em attitude that he went and got people's life savings and then stole it. He was just like, yeah. I remember because my Twitter and my Facebook filled up with people who were like, you know, business advice from Jordan Belfort, which is weird because getting business getting trading advice from Jordan Belfort is like getting Adolf Hitler to plan the seating at your wedding dinner. Yes, he's probably going to get the job done, but not in a way that you expect or maybe would like at all.
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way that we don't admire Bonnie and Clyde for their go-get-em attitude.
Yeah.
And, but we could set these people up as paragons. I mean, Genghis Khan is a popular example. Genghis Khan is the most successful human being in the history of the world, in the history of ever, Genghis Khan has ruled the most territory, controlled the largest empire, and had the most proportional to time wealth. Genghis Khan so killed so many people, it cooled the earth a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, but we could hold him up as a paragon of courage. Paragon. This is tied in with the notion of virtuous villains, but at the same time, it is hard to say that Genghis Khan, who is a warrior, who led armies in battle, and who planned strategy and won victories, is not properly courageous. Mm-hmm. It is difficult to say that he does not have wisdom. And because we're cherry picking virtue ethicists, mm-hmm. So I mean we don't need to worry too much about the compassion. We can admire him and hold him up as a paragon of, say, courage. Mm-hmm. But that seems like a problem, because I feel like if I met a person who said, you know, I really admire Genghis Khan for the way he just got things done, I worry that person is going to raid my yurt and in the middle of the night and steal my horses and possibly make off with my women folk. Mm-hmm. That is a concern that I have. Mm-hmm. Because when you think, what would Genghis Khan do? That's what he would do. Mm-hmm. You know, what would Jordan Belfort do? He would steal all your money.
Yeah. No, this is definitely an issue. And it, you know what? It might sound silly to discuss, but a relevant example really comes down to, like, the cult of personality when it comes to celebrity worship and stuff. Okay. So you really admire them for this or that achievement or this or that thing, and then they do something or something comes to light, and suddenly you have to reevaluate whether or not you want to look up to this person. You know, like, Hitler was Time's Man of the Year at one point.
He was Time's Man of the Year in a bad way, though. That was a last minute editorial decision.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So maybe that doesn't fit in with the example.
Mussolini was, though.
Yeah.
And they were pretty behind him.
Yeah. So I think that this is an actual problem.
But I would like to think that the case of whether or not Genghis Khan is a nice guy is pretty settled.
Yeah. No. But yeah, I'm talking about what would be a really good example? Gandhi.
Okay.
Gandhi, yeah. No, advocated peace. Advocated peace. Horrible racist in that when he was working in a paper in, like, South Africa. Mm-hmm. Right. Mother Teresa, wonderful woman for, like, trying to tend to the poor, but those poor houses that she had were very poorly managed and whatnot. Right. I mean, like, there's that you can always find holes and things to pick at with individuals that are typically held up as more exemplars. So
I hesitate to think that leading an army that conquers most of Europe is a hole that you find. But yeah, no. But I mean, in the sense that
I'm trying to stick to
my worry about to sort of articulate my worry more clearly. It's that nothing stops me in virtue ethics from holding up Genghis Khan as a paragon, and in fact, like I said, he seems to make a very strong case for it. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be this prevailing opinion that I shouldn't. And this maybe goes back to the fact that Genghis Khan doesn't have lots of other virtues, like mm-hmm. probably temperance. Mm-hmm. Genghis Khan, not a man famous for his control. Mm-hmm. I guess what's the virtue that stops you from kidnapping people? He probably doesn't have that one. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of things that he probably didn't have. Mm-hmm. But if I get to pick, and I pick, like, if I get to pick my paragons, and I should, and my paragon is Genghis Khan, I mean, arguably that's going to lead me astray, mm-hmm. And away from virtues. But what stops me from doing that? Yeah. I mean, I can just, if Genghis Khan suits my idea of virtues, then
My only solution to this is ultimately, I want to find a solution that doesn't ultimately come down to the no true Scots solution.
That seems like a reasonable thing to want.
No true person of virtue would ever do this. Is kind of a meaningless thing.
Maybe the solution is I have to understand part of the virtue that I'm looking for in a paragon,
mm-hmm.
in order to pick one.
I guess, or accepting or understanding the limitations of what it is you're trying to admire in the person. I mean, like, yeah, you can say admire the ruthless efficiencies in the way an atrocity is carried out, but really,
that seems horrible.
I know. I'm trying to take your example of like somebody who's done something wrong, and like you're finding something to admire in them. But it's, I don't know. It's like
silver lining inside the exhaust fumes.
That's what I'm trying to get at. It's like when you're defending your choice so much by narrowing in on this really tiny little section of it.
Okay.
I think it might be just missing the point. Like, there are far better examples, or there are far more compassionate
individuals that you can admire. No one has led better or larger armies than Genghis Khan. No one has conquered more territory. I mean, that's the thing. He's the most successful human ever. The values of success espoused by his culture and by European culture in that time.
Yeah, no, and the big thing, the other thing I would say is, I think virtue ethics, along with every other ethical theory, needs to ensure that it's relevant to the current time in which it finds itself.
Okay.
So updating the virtues from Aristotle to more present day.
So, I mean, I admire Genghis Khan's go-get-em attitude. I admire his willingness to take risks and things like that, but I think that leads into the idea that I have to understand the virtue in order to pick my paragon properly.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to lead into a different issue, which is that if I understand the virtue sufficiently that I could pick a proper paragon, pick a proper paragon is the tongue twister of the week, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could pick a proper paragon, then do I need my paragon anymore because I understand what I need to learn from them? It seems like they don't have anything more to teach me,
mm-hmm.
because I understand what I have to learn. And if I understand it, it's not like learning facts. What I'm trying to learn is a behavior.
So I actually have an answer for this that I just thought of now that I didn't think of when we were working in the pre-show. Let me try to explain it by way of analogy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
Ryan, the analogy guy.
Sure. When you learn how to drive, right? You study the book, so you learn everything you can from the book. You take driver's ed, you learn from an individual. You get lots of experience, right? So by the time, say, you get your G license, there's a pretty good chance that you know really how to drive a car. Like, you understand how to drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't say that just because you understand the like the basics, like the definition, the concepts of driving, that you are able to successfully drive in every single contingent condition that comes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first time you get thrown into a giant, thick, foggy patch of road, right? You understand the principles of turning off high beams if you had them on, and you know, going down to the fog lights kind of deal. But you don't really, like, you have to draw upon, it helps to draw upon the experiences of others. Or when you're driving through, like, blizzard conditions, you know, it's terrifying to do that. The way I see virtue coming out in that, or cash out in that regard, is you can understand the definition of what it means to be courageous. You can understand what it means to show courage, but sometimes you don't know how to discharge courage in every single case. So a little bit more relevant example for me would be when I became a security guard. Took the course. I understand the mechanics of being a security guard. I got my license. Then they threw me into the bathroom position at the bar because it is the best place to learn how to be observant in the bar because of the amount of territory you have to watch as the guard, the amount of people that you're going to be interacting with because everybody has to use a washroom or has to go to the washroom at some point, and most people at a bar at some point will go in and out of the washroom, right? But that's not to say that every single time I'm interacting with a customer or dealing with a problem, I'm going to know exactly how to go about doing it. So I think we're doing a little bit of a disservice if we say that if I understand courage enough to pick a mentor, that I think we're not appreciating the complexity of what's going on in this virtue. I mean, virtues are, as you pointed out, they're very basic. Not basic, but they're very base. Like they're very rock bottom. There's not much lore you can really pick it apart. But when it comes to discharging the virtues or discharging your behaviors in accordance with virtue, I think that we're not appreciating the nuances of reality and the complexities of other people. Because that's the other thing. I'm with Sart. Hell is other people. Other people make things incredibly difficult. And a lot of times, when you're dealing with other people, if they weren't there, things would be a lot simpler, yes. Right?
This bar would be so much easier to manage if it was empty.
We might not make as much money, but it would be a lot easier to manage if there were less people.
Ryan Huckle business model.
Yeah, you can tell I'm never going to make money. So that would be one response. Okay. I think one of my stronger responses.
So as someone who has learned how to drive, but does not actually drive, it seems to me that what you are describing is that the only way to learn how to drive and how to deal with conditions isn't to be told about them by a mentor. And paragons are not mentors. You usually don't have that kind of relationship with your paragon. Paragon, Superman is arguably a paragon, or Wonder Woman, or fictional characters can be moral paragons. In fact, they make really great moral paragons often because they don't have human flaws, and that also makes them really boring fictional characters. But the only way for me to learn how to deal with those, or how to drive in general, is by doing it and making errors and correcting errors and things like that. But I feel like it's weird to think that if I were on the road, and I'm like, what would Ricky Bobby do? What would my driver, or just my driving instructor, what would my driving instructor do when he's out here? That is a weird way to think about it, rather than, especially if I already know all of the procedures, because what my driving instructor would tell me is to do that.
I was trying to simplify into a skill, because it would be the same thing with the virtuous villains of, if I wanted to go and rob this bank, how would I execute this in such a way that I could, do it better, so to speak. I was using it as an example, and then the same with the security guard example of, you can know what it takes to be a brave security guard, having never had to step in the middle of a bar fight, or having never had to rush in to go
and help somebody. That's a lack of experience, but it doesn't seem like the notion of a paragon would help me there. My paragon doesn't help me be brave. My paragon tells me what I know what I should do, but I already know what I should do.
Yeah, but what usually happens with me, especially when I make mistakes at the bar and I get active feedback from more senior, more experienced people, is I take that and I internalize that of, this is how it should be done, or
and that seems perfectly reasonable. I mean, nobody's going to get it right the first time every time.
Yeah,
but there's a sense in which, If I understand, the idea with virtues is that they're elemental, they exist, they're on a basic level, and that if I understand it well enough, to understand that, especially because being a paragon is such a nuanced thing to be, because Genghis Khan maybe not a paragon of courage, so I already have to have a presumably a reasonably nuanced understanding of this virtue that I sort of don't need them But I guess I'm willing to bracket it. The last shot that I would love to take at Virtue Ethics is that there exists this one virtue that we have been talking about the whole time, and that Aristotle talks about, and that every virtue ethicist talks about. It is the most important virtue, the super virtue. And it seems like, while all the virtues are a mean, I could never have too much wisdom. Too much intelligence, and you're a smart ass. You're a know-it-all. But too much wisdom. Wisdom doesn't make you a know-it-all. Wisdom, if you have so much wisdom, you know when to keep your mouth shut. And you know when to offer that wisdom and when not to. You know when to be courageous and when not to, because you are wise. And it's, so it seems like that is, it doesn't sit on a mean. We got this whole rule of mean going. We got temperateness, which is on a mean. We got courage. We got compassion, which we introduced. We've got some, the one that Philippa Foot introduces is justice. Society that is that exemplifies the moral virtues must have temperateness, courage, justice, and wisdom. And so I've got, but I've got wisdom here at the bottom, and the dial just goes to 11.
Yeah, wisdom is the one that seems to be the most binary. It's either, if, it's either up and, or
and,
down.
And if
yes
I,
or
and
no.
If I, and if I, if I have wisdom, and I am so wise, one day, maybe, probably not ever. If I am so wise that I know when to be courageous and I know how to be courageous, and then I, you know, and I am wise enough to know that I must be courageous, and I am. And the same with temperate, and the same with, do I really need any of the other virtues, or should I just be wise? Being wise seems like a really great deal.
I don't think you could. The way I conceive of it, and this might be wrong, I always see wisdom as kind of the emergent one. Again, it comes down to, unless you have all of them, you have none of them, right? So unless you have all, that's when you kind of max out your you cap out your level 99. You can be no wiser, right? Kind of deal. It feels like wisdom is something
until they release,
like,
the patch and raise the level cap.
Until they release the patch. So when Aristotle decides to release the next patch,
look, when we find Aristotle's patch notes, you're going to be so embarrassed. Also, you'll find out that virtue ethics totally got nerfed in the patch.
Yeah, maybe. But that's kind of the way I've tried to make sense of it in my mind, is that wisdom ultimately becomes wisdom, prudence, phrenesis, however you want to term it. It ultimately is kind of an emergent thing that you gain an understanding of when it is appropriate to act, when it's appropriate to act, how you're to act and whatnot. That comes out of tackling with the other virtues. It's, you know, learning to be a better security guard. You know, you don't make the same mistakes. You learn not to be aggressive all the time. You don't have to be a meathead and fight all the time. That there's better ways of doing your job. And of, you can succeed the job by being aggressive all the time, but it's not a good way to be a security guard. Not just because you'll probably get fired for being a meathead, but like it's, you slowly accumulated over time. Some people seem wise because they're able to make the connections faster, or they get it right the first time and they never have to learn by trial and error. You know, it's just they happen to on the first trial get it. But that's a lot of times how I see wisdom. It's just the emergent property of having or working on your virtues. Maybe it's not a satisfying answer, but ultimately that's why I like virtue ethics, because I don't have to try to proselytize other people. As long as it makes sense to me and I don't bother anybody else with it, it's okay.
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, I am not a virtue ethicist. I hold to a sort of best practice-y, wishy-washy stakeholder thing that I wrote my thesis on. And we'll maybe do a two-part stakeholder theory throwdown next season. But depends on how the virtue ethics one goes. If you guys like it, then leave a comment. And we'll see about it. But, I mean, ultimately, as much as I make fun of virtue ethics, and I will continually and forever poke fun at you for being a die-hard virtue ethics ethicist. Cherry-picking virtue ethicist. To the point where you've just defended it for almost 2 hours.
No.
It does not seem like a terrible way to run your life. It is unlikely that you will meet virtue people who believe in virtuous people or in practicing virtues, who also think that, you know, the best person that they whose example they could follow is Genghis Khan.
Yeah,
it's not likely. It's maybe a blind spot of virtue ethics, but it's not a blind spot that a lot of people live in.
Mm-hmm.
At least I hope not.
No.
But
there are a lot of assholes out there, though, so...
Well, I would hope that the Venn diagram of people who are jerks and people who are virtue ethicists has a reasonably small overlap.
Yeah.
But then again, Aristotle doesn't recognize compassion as a virtue, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, not to say that just because it wasn't a part of the culture excuses it, but
yeah,
it really was a different culture. It's hard to compare apples.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. It's been 2,500 years. We've had time, and that's the thing. There's lots of contemporary virtue ethics scholarship that's still going on.
Yeah,
there's lots of really interesting things being written about it, and like I said, it is not a terrible way to run your life.
And to be, again...
It's just not the right way.
Perhaps. Ryan. Perhaps. To be anti-Wubnik again, there was... Most of the time, the Greeks are held up as, like, the golden age of civilization. And I don't remember who... It was a lecture series I was listening to, but somebody said, no, they're the infants of society. They were the precursors. Just because they came first and had a whole bunch of innovations, which, by the way... They weren't necessarily the first ones to innovate. Hello, Egypt and China.
Yeah.
I mean, Aristotle probably wasn't the first virtue ethicist when you really get down to it. But nevertheless, we've come a long way, and we've realized that we need to amend and make addendums to the canon.
I feel like this is a terribly existentialist thing to say, and it's going to be super depressing for the end of our season. But when people talk about, as somebody who spent a lot of time studying ancient history in university, when people talk about, you know, the past and the romanticism of the past that we tend to do in the golden age of society, whether that's when people lived off the land or people were, you know, more self-sufficient, or they weren't continually bothered by their iPhones. The thing with the golden age of society is that we live in it now. People are better off. They have more opportunities. They have longer lifespans. And as much as we sort of wander through our lives often thinking about how much they suck, this is the best that we have ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it still sucks just means that we've got farther to go.
We have to continue to work on the virtues.
Ooh.
I think that, you know, I think that's as existential as it is, that also has a kernel of truth that just because it's the best it's ever been now does not mean it's the best it's ever going to be.
I hope
and
not.
We can continue to work. We can continue to the forward progress, and you know what? Learn from our mistakes, adjust our values, realize that we need to jettison old ways of thinking in favor of new, more egalitarian thinking.
Yeah.
And,
But I think that is the message that we should exit our first season on.
Seems like a good way to cap off season one. Nice feather in the hat.
So, yeah, thank you so much for listening or watching or both to the first season of the Concept Crucible podcast. There will be a link at the end if this is your first episode, then welcome. And there's a link at the end if you want to go back to the beginning of the playlist. We will be back in 2015 with a new season, and we've got a lot of exciting stuff planned. God forbid there might be more than just two of us. It's going to be a really good time. We're going to travel a bit, so I recommend the video version as well as the audio version.
Mm-hmm.
But the audio version is much better to carry on your iPod. We fit in your pocket now. It's great. But yeah, thank you guys so much for watching and listening and commenting. And I hope that you comment more because it's a lot of fun. And we will be back next year. But for the last time this year, I am Jim.
And I'm Ryan.
And we are signing off.
Stay awesome. And bottom. There we go. That was a solid hit. Did you see that? That was a solid hit. There's a lot of energy put into that.
This is the Concept Crucible podcast where we have bunk beds.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's a hell of a way to end this series, I suppose.
Totally reverse our high five.
Yeah. It shows growth.
Fertility. Yeah. Ambidexterity.
Yeah. Well, we couldn't get it right the last time we filmed.
I know, it was hilarious.
This was I awkwardly was trying to hit you. Seems like.